Hey, everybody. Bill Shirk, the man about the woods for the Minnesota Historical Society. You know, you need to come visit historic Fort Snelling. It's Minnesota's first national historic landmark, and it just reopened May 28th after 2 years of restoration. This is the place where waters, people, and ideas have come together for thousands of years. People are able to hear many stories told by many voices and learn more about how lives and history intersect. Whether revisiting your favorite parts of history or learning something new, it's waiting for you at historic Fort Snelling. Hey, you can learn more at mnhs.org/Fort Snelling. We'll see you there.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Minnesota Bound Podcast, the stories behind the stories. I'm Laura Sherry, your host for today, and I am in studio at the production company with a lovely lady by the name of Jamie Rockney. Jamie, welcome to the Minnesota Bound Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Jamie, your nickname, not your nickname, but your pseudonym name or whatever, is Chick of the Woods. And I met Jamie, you and I met when we were out foraging for morel mushrooms with Mike Kempinick, and he's been on the Minnesota Bound Podcast before. He's known as the Gentleman Forager. And I wanted to chat with you, Jamie, on the podcast today because you had such an interesting story, and this is a recent story, on why you decided to follow your passion in life, which is basically all about mushrooms. And you recently decided to become a mushroom forager full time.
I did, yes.
Now, and you left a corporate job to do mushroom foraging full time. Now, I kind of want to go back in time a little bit and chat with me about, like, where did this passion for mushrooms come from?
Oh, well, it actually didn't start out that great with mushrooms. I had a couple bad experiences when I was 4 years old. I was told, I don't remember this exactly, but my mom told me that I went out foraging in the backyard and took my brother and we ate all the mushrooms in the backyard. And
oh my goodness.
That ended up
Were you
poorly.
Sick?
Well, my mom made us sick. She gave us some syrup of Ipecac and it did its job.
Brutal. That's like what you saw in the movies in the 80s. Well, somebody had to drink castor oil. What movie was that? Was that Stand By Me or something?
It was Stand By Me.
Yes, yep. And this is Brandon joining us. He's our producer of the podcast. I love having Brandon join in on the podcast. Was it that experience where you like drank the oil and like 5 minutes later you were over a toilet?
Exactly. Well, So what happened, like I said, as the story is told by my mother, she gave us the dose of the syrup of Ipecac, I think is what it's called, and it didn't work. So she was freaking out. So, you know, you wait the 15, 20 minutes or however long it's supposed to take, and it didn't work. So then she gave us another dose.
Oh,
well,
my God.
They both ended up working.
Oh, my goodness.
We had one episode, and then another 20 minutes later, where's another? So,
My goodness. Well, that'll be a good lesson not to pick and eat things in the backyard.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, who even has that? What is it called? Syrup of what?
Ipecac, I think.
Does anybody even have that in their kitchen cabinets or bathroom cabinet anymore? I mean,
I think it was something back in the 80s that parents had to have in the 80s and 90s. Yeah.
Remember there, she was probably looking at the Mr. Yuck sticker. That was the poison control number. I don't think we even have that anymore either, but well, I'm thankful that you're okay. And that's this is you and your brother?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So you obviously had some sort of desire to kind of forage and feast on wild things at a very young age.
Right. Yeah.
And then did you...
I was a good eater.
Yes, apparently. Did you continue to... follow the foraging path even through high school, or did you decide to just get into it later in life? How did it pop up for you?
So, yeah, it's funny. Like, after that episode, we kind of got put on hold for 20 years. Like, I don't honestly even remember seeing a mushroom in my life, you know, up until about 20 years later, when a friend of mine took me out mushroom hunting, and it was morel season, and we went hiking for hours, and we were up and down the hills and through the brush, and you know, didn't find anything. And then we got to this spot, and he's like, "Well, do you see anything?" I'm like, "Nope." looking and I didn't see anything. And there, you know, then he pointed out, "Well, look there and there," and it's morel mushrooms, of course. And then they kind of start popping out you know, as you see the first one, you see more. But I'm like, well, this is stupid. Yeah. I would never find these things. So I just thought it was kind of ridiculous that people would go looking for something that's so hard to find.
True.
So, so then again, yeah, second not so positive experience. But then he introduced me to the hen of the woods later in that fall, and that's a really big mushroom that's really easy to see. So
is that also known as a pheasant back, or is that different?
No, that's totally different.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't even know what a hen of the woods looks like, but...
Yeah, there's hen of the woods and chicken of the woods, hence the name chick of the woods.
Okay, love it.
So hen of the woods is a big mushroom that can be, I mean, I found them 15 pounds. I know they can grow much bigger than that, I think maybe 40 pounds, but so it goes right at the base of an oak tree. So, and it gets its name hen of the woods because the mushroom has like these... petals that almost look like feathers on the back of a chicken, like if a chicken was all like ruffled up.
Sure.
So, you know, if you use your imagination, you can see a hen in the woods all ruffled up. So those grow right at the base of an oak tree. So he's like, well, let's go check, you know, see if we can find some hen of the woods. And we walked out, and like the first or second tree, there was this giant mushroom at the base of the tree. I'm like, wow.
That's cool.
This is something I could see. And so then... I thought that was super cool. And
did you enjoy eating mushrooms at the time? So were you cooking these mushrooms up, and is that where you were really hooked when you just, I mean, of course, morel mushrooms taste amazing. And
yeah,
that's probably part of, I mean, A, why people are willing to search long and hard for morel mushrooms because they taste so good, but also because they're so rare. I think it's almost like finding the leprechaun, mm-hmm. and people kind of have this adrenaline rush of finding morel mushrooms. They're bragging to their friends about how many they found. And I think that's part of the culture of the morel mushroom. But the other mushrooms, are you just a mushroom fanatic as far as like cooking and eating mushrooms?
Well, I wasn't at the time,
sure.
You know, but then when I tasted this mushroom, this hen of the woods, like, I don't want anybody to know, but it's like almost as good, if not better. I don't know. It's right there with the morel mushroom.
Is like, it really?
It is that good. And you can find so much of it at one point, and you know, of course, you'll have to preserve some because you can't possibly eat that much. But as I learned about it, it just kept building and building. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. You know, that's, of course, a lot of it is the thrill of the hunt too. You know, you never know if you're going to find anything. And yeah, there's so many reasons why I love, mushroom hunting. The food and the eating is just like a small part of it.
A small part of it. So, and you eventually decided that you were going to leave your full-time job to do this full-time. So mm-hmm. how did that opportunity come about?
So, I had been foraging for 13 years or so. And most of the time I was doing this by myself because mushroom hunters are kind of loners. We don't like to share our spots.
Yes. People are very secretive about their mushroom finding spots. Yes.
But then I started taking friends out. You know, there were some people that would ask about coming out. I'm like, well, you can come anytime. And you know, most of the time, you know, people are busy. They just don't do it. But then I had, this one friend of mine that, you know, he came out with me, and we were just having such a great time. Or he was so excited. Like when I would show him something, and he's like, "Oh my gosh, that's amazing!" I'm like, "Well, you didn't know about that? Oh yeah, you know, it was not just mushrooms. There was wild grapes and plums and a few other things that we found besides the mushrooms." And he's like, gosh, Jamie, you could like get paid to do this. I'm like, oh yeah, right. I'm like, that would be so awesome. But like, nobody would ever do that. And then a little bit after that, I had a girl that was actually buying some morel mushrooms from me. And she's like, would you ever like take me out mushroom hunting if I paid you? And I'm like,
well, wait a minute.
sure. Yeah. Yeah, I would love to do that. And so I took her out, just her. And when I saw her get so excited about the mushrooms that we found, it was just like this amazing feeling. Like, it was more fun watching her get excited about the mushrooms than me finding them myself. And she was already obsessed about mushrooms. She has a tattoo of an Amanita mushroom on her wrist. But she didn't mushroom hunt. She just liked them. So that was kind of the beginning of it. And she kind of inspired me to actually advertise that I was going to be doing guided mushroom hunts. So I did that, you know, through Facebook and stuff. And I had started doing that. And in that process, I, you know, came up with the name Chick of the Woods and started a Facebook page just so I could geek out about my mushrooms, because I felt bad. I kept putting mushroom, you know, pictures on my personal page. I'm like, oh gosh, you know, my friends are so annoyed of me.
So like, here comes another shroom in the feed.
Yeah. So I created my own page just so I could put all my pictures there and stuff. So anyway, I had just kind of started dabbling with that, and I went to this event called Murals and Memories, which is a fundraiser for Alzheimer's put on by a family in Watertown. And they were looking for guides. And I had seen that Mike Kempenick with Gentleman Forager was also a guide there. I'm like, oh, cool. Like, I could be a guide. You know, I could do that. And so when I went, I, of course, introduce myself. He's kind of a big deal
in the mushroom world. Absolutely. Mike is definitely a mushroom celebrity. Yes. For sure.
So yeah, I was a little bit nervous coming up to talk to him, but I introduced myself, and I had made a Chick of the Woods shirt, and so he saw that and he's like, Chick of the Woods, hey, I might have to steal that. And I'm like, well, yeah. Actually, yeah, you can't.
No, you're like, that belongs to me.
Yeah, so then we started talking, and he found out that I was kind of doing the same thing as him. And, you know, we got along great. And then afterwards, he's like, well, we should talk. You know, let's meet up and talk if maybe we could partner on some things. And so we met and talked and just kind of realized we're definitely like in the same place as far as our mushroom obsession, I guess. And so he had kind of started planting the seed in my head that, you know, maybe we could work together and potentially be business partners. And one of the things that he liked about me is not only my passion for mushrooms, but just the simple fact that I don't have kids. And I'm not married, so like I don't have a lot of commitments and things that are like tying me home. So with him, you know, he travels a lot, you know. Yes. Traveling up north to pick mushrooms or whatever it might be. So like that was kind of a neat aspect to him, just thinking this could possibly work. So he had just kept talking about that. And I'm going to answer your question eventually here.
No, it's good. It's a great story.
So, yeah, then it was just this last spring. And I had a wonderful job. I really did. I worked with government. I had great benefits. It was just wonderful. Great coworkers. I was doing water conservation, so things to improve lakes and streams. Like, really great. But I had started getting into a different role where I was in the office all the time and I didn't get to get out on the lakes or by the streams anymore. So I was just getting a little bit, you know, like kind of frustrated when I wanted to be outside. Like I just love being outside. So springtime came around and morels were kind of in the forecast. And I started thinking about the fact that I really don't want to be locked inside when the morels are out, and I knew it was ramping up to be a good season. So
the mushrooms were calling.
Yeah. And Mike had kind of said like, well, if you're ready to take the leap, you know, I'd love to have you. And so the timing just kind of worked out, and yeah.
And here you are.
Here I am. Yes.
Hewitt Docks, Lifts, and Pontoon Legs began in a small south central Minnesota town with a mission to make dock install and removal easier by inventing the Rolodock. Well, now the company has evolved to provide everything you might need to improve your lake time. In addition to the classic Rolodock or the new Ultra Dock system, Hewitt offers all-terrain staircases, gangways, canopies, and lifts, along with any accessory you might need. Celebrate 50 years of business with us. Go to HewittRad.com to enter for a chance to win a free dock and monthly prizes. Hewitt Docks, Lifts, and Pontoon Legs. Work hard, play harder. You deserve a Hewitt.
Hi there, Ron Shera here for Star Bank. If you're putting your money into mega banks down the street, who knows where that money's being used? Bank locally. Keep your money local with a community bank that actually cares about you, your family, your business, and your goals. Check out the bank we use at Minnesota Bound. Try Minnesota's own Star Bank. You can find them online at starbank.net. When you call Star Bank, you actually hear a real living person answering the phone. Star Bank has 10 convenient locations around Minnesota to serve you and all the mobile banking products that you need to manage your money. Check out all that Star Bank has to offer at starbank.net.
Hey, I'm really picky when it comes to my drinking water, and I have the reverse osmosis drinking water system from Kinetico, and I love it. It takes out contaminants in the water, it removes chlorine, and most important, it tastes great, which is the one thing I'm probably most picky on is how does my water taste. So having Kinetico also means that I use less plastic water bottles, which we all know is a definite bonus for our environment. For more information, visit Kinetico.com to find a dealer near you.
Well, and I when I was chatting with you when we were in River Falls, Wisconsin, we can't give the exact location, of course, because that would be an anti-mushroom forager thing to do. But we were having such a great time, and you're telling me your story, and I always admire people who follow their passions, and they take risks to do that, of course, calculated risks, and because I never think you can go wrong or fail when you truly follow your heart and follow your passion and you're willing to work hard, because it still requires work, of course, but to make sure that it can work. But I just thought it was so interesting that there's not a lot of people that would decide to leave a comfortable job that they know is, you know, so secure to really follow their passion. But so I wanted to have you on because, you know, I've not done a ton of mushroom foraging myself. It's always so fun when you do. And to me, it's still a little intimidating. But to have a female voice out in the mushroom foraging world is also awesome and amazing. And so I thought, you know what, I'm gonna have Jamie come on the Minnesota Bound podcast. I gotta hear this story and how she decided to go chase mushrooms for a living. And I think you're hitting it right at the right time, because there is this, seems like there's a boom going on with people being very curious and interested in foraging for their own food. If that is foraging for mushrooms, for you know, wild black raspberries, to there's a lot of edible quote unquote weeds out there, or plants that people, you know, may be pulling out of their yards that they can eat. And also there's been a huge increase in interest in hunting and just knowing where your food comes from. And that it's also being a very sustainable source of food. And so you are at the peak of, or even pre-peak of, I think, where this could go for you eventually too, as far as just the popularity of foraging for your own things.
Right.
And you're, you know, of course, joining with gentleman forager, Mike Kempenick, you just can't go wrong there. But there, what I didn't realize with mushrooms in general, you know, the morel mushroom, that's what you hear about the most here in Minnesota, but there are a lot of different mushroom species that you can forage for here. And you guys were sharing that with me when we were out, that the heaviest of foraging happens in the middle of the summer. Is that correct?
Yeah, for sure.
Like, what are some of the other species you can eat?
Oh, there's so many.
No, chanterelles. That's one.
The more popular ones that people go for are, yeah, chanterelles. Like you said, those are, there's probably just tiny little ones out there right now. So in July, chanterelles, July, August, it's perfect for them. There's boletes, there are chicken of the woods, hen of the woods, just like you can't even imagine how many different ones are out there. I forget about them until I see them again.
For sure.
I found some coral mushrooms. They literally look like coral that grows in the sea, that grow on logs, and oyster mushrooms. They grow all year long. Yeah.
And what do you think the fascination is? Like, why are people so fascinated with mushrooms? Like, I'm so curious.
No, I try to think about that too. Like, why am I so obsessed with this? they're just, it seems like they're an alien. You know, some of these are just like aliens. Like, how on earth did this thing, like form. The colors are so brilliant. There's some that are so tiny and some that are so huge, and just, you know, and then the taste of them too, they all taste completely different. It's, you know, like, you know, comparing an apple to an orange, really, you know, they're the same species, but they're not, they're not the same. I don't know.
But some of the ones that are bright color, I feel like those would scare me the most, because when we were out, you showed me one that was like bright, bright neon orange. And you're like, this is an example of what you do not eat.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's safe to say that the reason you have job security as well is because you need to be very careful about what you are eating. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to start venturing out and don't do what Jamie did when she was a young girl and just go eat everything in the backyard, you should take a class.
Yeah.
Do you suggest that there's,
yeah, unfortunately, yeah, there aren't any like hard and fast rules. Like you said, like the bright orange ones, like, yeah, they look hazardous. But yeah, there aren't any rules that you can really follow that are going to just let you go out into the woods and pick randomly and feel comfortable about it. So yeah, that's definitely like the main thing that we are doing with Gentleman Forager is doing the classes, different levels. We have a lot of different options. You know, if you want to just kind of go out in the woods and wander around and, you know, we'll just talk about the ones that we pick and, you know, take home whatever we find. We also will do like in class, classrooms with a presentation and a PowerPoint and, you know, kind of delve into maybe four different mushrooms and like just kind of talk about everything there is to know about those four mushrooms. And then at those classes, I'll talk about plants too. So we've got one coming up, I think it's July 10th, where we're going to do a presentation talking about four different like summer mushrooms, and I'm going to be talking about four different berries. And then we, you know, just to kind of get really into that, and then we'll do actually like a cooking demo on how to cook wild mushrooms and feed them. And then we'll go out foraging in the woods and find, you know, hopefully find some of the ones that we talked about. But then also there'll be so many more that you just stumble upon while you're out there too. So there's a lot of different ways of learning how, you know, to mushroom hunt. And every, like almost every week or for sure every month brings different mushrooms. So every time you go out, you find something different, or different locations have different mushrooms. So it never stops changing, and it's so interesting, which is why I think I like love doing this, because you're just always finding new things and learning new mushrooms. And
are they still finding new mushroom species popping up? Like in the dragonfly world, I was going out with some dragonfly experts, and they said that they still find new species of dragonflies every single year, and specifically even here in Minnesota. And
wow.
I'm like, how is that possible?
Right.
And that dragonflies migrate like thousands of miles. That's also like fascinating to me. But I would think that would be the same thing with mushrooms. Are they still finding like new mushroom species all the time?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
so interesting.
Real nerdy scientific fungi guys.
They're such fun guys.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I've gotten to that point where I would know that I found a new species, you know, because I would just be like, oh, I don't know that one yet. But maybe I have found new species, but I don't know it because I just assume, well, I haven't learned that one yet.
Of course.
I certainly don't know all of them, or, you know, or even most of them. There's so many out there that just take so long to identify. And, you know, maybe they're just really small, or, you know you're not going to eat that one because there's just some little ones. But yeah, so definitely, yeah. The classes are, I don't know, the hands-on is just so much better when you have an expert there that can look at it with you, and, you know, you can touch it, you can smell it. A lot of them smell, like have a certain smell to them. Like you mentioned that pheasant back, if you remember smelling that one.
I do.
It had
like
the
cucumber or something?
Yeah, either people will say cucumber or watermelon rind. So like if you are out there, you smell it, you get it, you know, like that sticks with you, and you can then go out again on your own and be like, oh yeah, I remember this, rather than, I don't know, when you read things, I think it's a little bit harder to remember. And you just want that like confidence of somebody saying, yes, that's absolutely edible.
And absolutely. And then also there's this whole, timeline on when they're best to eat, because when we were out foraging, some of the, even the morels that we were finding were probably on the older side. And you said, of course you can reconstitute them underwater or something where they bring them back to life, but they probably wouldn't taste as good. Mm-hmm. And then they're Same with the pheasant back. You thought the one that we found was probably just a little too old to be eating. You could eat it. It's not going to taste the best. You know, what are some of the, you know, I guess tips? How do you know, like, when the mushroom is, like, perfect eating at the age that it should be eaten?
Right. Well, yeah.
It's different species.
Yeah, for sure. You know, depends on the mushroom. If there's a bunch of worms in there, that's always a whole other conversation.
There was a worm on one that we found, and you know, I brought a little satchel home, which was so fun. I did eat those; they're so good. But when I was cleaning them, you know, I have been pheasant hunting and deer hunting, whatever, and I was probably more got a little queasy at the worm in the mushroom than I did and anything else I've done in out in the outdoors. And I was like, how do you actually get these clean? How do you get all the little beetles off? Because there is that whole process. I was just soaking in water. I don't know if I even did it right. I was probably should have asked, but then my mom's like, I think you use salt water. How do you get these mushrooms clean?
Yeah. Well, morels, yeah, those are kind of hard because they have all those little divots all over. And then if it rains, it'll splash up onto the mushroom. And then if it grows after it gets splashed on, sometimes you just can't eat them because the mushroom will actually kind of grow around the dirt. So sometimes at some point you definitely are just like, this is not worth it. Yeah. But I typically don't soak my mushrooms. Like with the morels, I'll take the kitchen sink sprayer just to kind of get the grit off that way.
Okay.
If your mushroom has that many worms in it that you have to soak it in water, salt water to have them float out, you know, like
probably not
maybe,
a good idea.
Maybe you just want to pass, but some people do that. We just typically don't recommend soaking them in water for too long. And you are going to be cooking them. So like if there's any sort of,
you know, it's a little extra protein in there. Yeah. There's a little worm or something. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, you do definitely get used to seeing those worms. And some of them are just like almost impossible to find without worms, like oysters and chanterelles. Around here, especially the chanterelles get really wormy. So you just have to be out there right away and get them. Or you just, you know, like if there's a few, I'm just like, all right, yeah, I'm going to cook this up. It'll be just fine. You really won't see it.
Just don't worry about it. I mean, you keep hearing all these cricket farms going up that's going to be our next food source at some point or be a part of it. So let's just add the worms right in there.
Exactly.
Hopefully those aren't going to make you need the, was it Epicac syrup?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's what it's
it should be called Epi-Yak syrup because that is indeed what happens. So I was reading on some interesting mushroom facts, which mushrooms are super fascinating. And I'm not a mushroom scientist, and I'm guessing, Jamie, you're not either yet. But someday. One thing that I was reading that's really super cool, it says fungi, mushrooms, are genetically closer to humans than they are plants.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
That is wild.
Yeah.
And then when we were out foraging with Mike, he was saying that the mushroom and the tree almost communicate to each other based off of, like, if we didn't have mushrooms, we wouldn't have trees, and vice versa, because they eat all the dead matter.
Right. Yeah.
And that, you know, they are an very integral part of our environment. Mm-hmm. And if they were not part of our environment, I don't know if our earth would even exist.
It would be a whole different earth, that's for sure. But yeah, there's different mushrooms do different roles. Some of them will break down matter, but then some of them are parasitic, so they'll actually kill a tree, you know. And then some of them are symbiotic, where the relationship, the mushroom and the plant of whatever, you know, usually a tree, but not always, it actually benefits both of them, that they, you know, need each other to grow. So it's amazing all the different roles that they.
So interesting. And was it the maple tree that has some sort of antifungal properties to it?
Yeah.
Was it the maple tree?
Yeah.
That if you see maple trees when you are foraging for morels or I guess any other mushroom, you might as well just keep on walking because the tree itself has antifungal properties to it where mushrooms won't even grow around it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't understand how it all works. But there is one mushroom that grows on a maple tree that I know of. I'm sure there are more, but a northern tooth mushroom, which is an edible. But yeah, typically, I don't know how it all works. But if you see a maple forest, you're just like, out of here.
Yeah, keep going.
I love trees, but maples are pointless in my world.
Yeah, you're just going to be walking around in circles forever. Mm-hmm. And also with, you know, for morel mushroom hunting too, some of the fun little tidbits that I was learning was that, you know, people are always like, oh, look for dead elm trees. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, my dad and I were out turkey hunting. He's always like, let's see if we can find some morels, look for dead elm trees. And actually it's better to look for elm trees that aren't quite dead yet.
Correct.
Right? There's the trick, people. Don't go looking for the completely dead elms. Yes. Find the ones that are just partially dying. And a lot of times you want to even look to the width of the top of the tree, right? Like how far out should you look from the base? Because a lot of times people just circle the base, or at least that's what I was doing. And both you and Mike were saying, no, you got to really, you can look out, you know, 5 feet from the base even, right?
Oh, yeah. So basically if you were to cut the tree down and it fell, you can that's kind of the...
How far out they can go.
Yeah. I wouldn't recommend looking that far out first. I would always, like in the case of morels, just kind of walk up to the tree slowly. And then if it has the morels growing around it, you'll typically find them growing close to it. But then if there's a lot, like then it'll kind of naturally just keep taking you further and further away from the tree. But you'd waste a lot of time if you started looking that far out at every tree, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because you really need to look carefully. You can step on the mushroom. Yes. It's very easy. And also, you know, you don't realize it's also tick season. So that was a whole nother thing that we were discovering quickly when we were out, that there was a lot of ticks, but also a lot of deer ticks. They were so tiny.
They were really tiny. Yeah.
And that's something to really keep in mind. Our photographer who grew up in Denver, he was with us and he had shorts and flip-flops on, and quickly I was like, Troy, I think you knew we were going mushroom foraging in the woods. But he quickly put on a change. Of course he had like some pants in his car and I think boots or something. So he's changed very quickly because he was discovering that was, probably the worst choice, but something to keep in mind when you're out there. It's like, you know, Lyme's disease is a serious thing.
And it really is.
You want to put the tick spray on and everything else you can.
I would say like the most effective chemical or spray out there is that permethrin. Like it really does the trick. There's kind of a lot of, not controversy, but you know, a lot of people don't like to use it because it is such a toxic chemical. But the way that you use it is you spray it on your clothes, not while it's on you, and then you put it on when it's dry.
Okay.
So like, especially if you could put it on like a pair of wind pants and then put those wind pants over your clothes, like that would be really ideal, but sometimes it's just too hot to do that. And it can affect cats. Like I think it can actually kill cats if they like, I think maybe when it's wet, I don't know about when it's dry, but, I definitely, that would be one if you want to do a chemical, that's the most effective. And then otherwise just check yourself. And I always say, don't just check yourself that night, like check in the morning too, just in case they were on your clothes or whatever, they might find you in the middle of the night.
They do too. They do, yeah. Like, and even to check, you said underneath your hairline, you know, on the back of your hairline, the back of your ears. The one deer tick that you found on you was so tiny. It was tinier than like a little pin dot.
Oh, yeah.
So you do have to be, very diligent, on your checking. But does any of like the lemongrass oil or any of those work effectively? Do you know? I mean,
yeah, I think
probably wouldn't
hurt. There definitely are some concoctions of essential oils and mixtures that you can make that help. It's just not as good as permethrin. But yeah, that would definitely,
you have choices.
Like, yeah, yeah.
Yes, you can go the chemical route, the natural route, and of course you can do a triple check route is always a good thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so I went on Google here to look up this fact that I saw about that mushrooms are genetically closer to humans than they are plants. And here they gave a list of a couple reasons why fungi are more like animals than they are plants, because they absorb nutrients from organic matter, unlike plants that produce their food through photosynthesis. Fungi have a fibrous substance called, I'm going to slaughter this name, chitin?
Ah, chitin.
Chitin?
Chitin.
Chitin. Thank you. See, I knew I was going to slaughter that word. It's a CH, by the way, so that's what got me there. Chitin.
Yeah.
In their cell walls. What do you know what chitin is?
Yeah, a little bit. Like,
just like a general
synopsis. It's like the outer layer of the cell, and it's like kind of like... What I understand is like, it's like a shell on a crustacean.
Oh, okay.
Like the shell.
Outer cell wall.
Yeah. And so it's really hard. And so that's why you need to cook your mushrooms, is because that chitin will build up in your body like over time, and you can actually like get some sort of toxicity effect if you just always ate raw mushrooms. Yeah, so when you cook it, you break that chitin down, and then it makes it edible.
So is that, do you think it's a higher level of chitin in toxic mushrooms that make them toxic, or is it other things? Do we know that answer?
No, I don't think that's, okay. I don't think that plays a role in it.
Anyway, but apparently plants do not have chitin. So that's interesting. And like us, fungi need food, water, and oxygen to survive. So they absorb the nutrients from their surroundings and expel waste products and CO2. That's fascinating.
Waste products. I wonder what they mean by that.
I have no idea, but that is wild.
I haven't seen any.
I haven't either. It's probably been
mushroom
searching.
Waste.
Well, that's super cool. So it's also said fungi are the largest life forms on Earth.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
The largest living organism on the planet is a single honey mushroom.
It's located in Oregon, yeah. Yep.
Is it really?
Yep. It's called humongous fungus or something
awesome.
Like that.
Awesome. Yeah. And there's a fungus among us. Do they protect this one large mushroom? It must be like fenced or something so people don't take
it. It's part of a forest. I think it's like a national forest or a state forest because it's all underground.
Exactly.
It's all just connected underground.
Wow.
So you really can't see it to an extent. So it's kind of cool.
Here they're saying it's 3.5 miles wide and occupies an area of 2,385 acres. And it's at least 2,400 years old and could be older. That is incredible.
That is incredible.
Yeah. So it holds the record for being the world's largest fungus.
Yeah. That's a good point too. Like just to mention that the mushroom isn't that is part of the mushroom, but the mushroom is like the fruit. So like when you talk about the mushroom, it's all underground and then like an apple tree grows an apple, that's what we're eating. So when we pick the mushroom, it's like picking an apple. It doesn't really affect the mushroom itself. You know, there's a lot of people that ask, well, do you pluck it or do you cut it? And, you know, like we believe it doesn't matter because it's all underground and you can do either and it's not going to harm. But if you pluck it, you just want to make sure you get that dirt off because otherwise it contaminates your basket with all the grit and grime. And then you really do have to spend more time cleaning it. Otherwise, you might not have to. So
that is fascinating. So that's why it makes sense that they would be communicating with the trees, because if it is an underground system, so it would matter if you cut it or plucked it. And also what you guys were sharing with me when we were out in the forest was that the life cycle of a morel mushroom, or I don't know if it applies to all the mushrooms, but it's usually like 4 to 5 years. So it would only produce mushrooms underneath that tree or around that tree for 4 to 5 years, and then it's over.
Yeah, however long it takes that tree to die dead, I guess, if you say. So it typically, I think, is about, 5 years, depending on the tree. So, maybe the first year or two, you'll have the biggest flush of mushrooms, and then as it gets closer to being dead, then it's, you'll just find fewer and fewer and fewer. So, it's hard to say you have a honey hole because one year it'll be amazing and then the next year that it might just only be a few of them around. But you can kind of have a honey hole if you have a forest that maybe has, a bunch of elm trees. So there's going to always be new elm trees dying. So it's maybe not one tree is going to be your honey hole forever, but maybe a certain forest has a ton of them. So you'll want to check that forest and different trees every year.
The Scherer family enjoys spending a lot of time outside, hence we care what goes into our environment. That's why we support propane, the energy for everyone. Did you know that propane produces fewer greenhouse gas emissions than electricity generated on the U.S. grid? Propane's emissions are 43% fewer. That's a lot. Propane is clean, dependable, and affordable. Plus, it's produced right here in the USA. Let's all do our part to reduce emissions from our homes, cabins, and businesses by choosing propane, the right energy right now. To learn more about propane, the energy for everyone, go to propane.com.
Hey there, Bill Shirk, the man about the woods. You know, today is a day for adventure, and Cub has all the Nabisco snacks you need to make sure that adventure is delicious from start to finish. Life is just sweeter when you share Oreo cookies on the trail. Also, when you crunch Ritz crackers at the campsite or rock the boat with rich cheese crispers. Stop a Cub on the way to your adventure. The great outdoors is calling. Be sure you bring the snacks.
I was just on a morning TV show called Minnesota Live, which is a morning news broadcast, and they wanted to chit-chat about fun things to do outdoors, and I actually was mentioning your Shroomapalooza coming up. I did give you guys a shout-out there, and we'll get to that in a minute, but Chris Eggert, who's one of the hosts of Minnesota Live, was saying that he had, like, baskets and baskets full of morel mushrooms in his backyard.
Oh, I hate him.
I know. That's what I said. I was like, do not let your neighbors know about that. And you probably better hide your address wherever it is, because you're going to have a line of people up next summer or next spring wanting to get after your backyard. Right. He's like, I didn't even know what to do with all of them. I was giving away to neighbors and this and this and that. And I, you know, after the little segment was wrapped, I told him, I said, you understand, like, per pound, if you want to buy morel mushrooms per pound, they're like $50 a pound, aren't they?
Yeah. Yep.
It's like gold.
That's what we sold them for this spring.
Did you really? Yep. That mm-hmm. is incredible. Well, now I know why you left your full-time job to go become a mushroom forager.
Well, and unfortunately, those morels are hollow. So it takes a bunch of them to, you know, equal a pound. And they are really hard to find and see. And, you know, so.
No, there's a lot of work there. It's like art, right? When an artist, you know, some people, whatever, they say, well, how long did it take you to paint that picture? And really, it's just about their talents. But that's kind of with mushroom hunting. Like, you're putting in a lot of hours. Yeah.
You don't want to calculate the hourly rate
to get a pound of morel mushrooms. No. And that's one other thing, too, that you know you have a morel mushroom. Because Megan, who is on the show, she said that her husband was foraging for mushrooms and he had morels. And she got really sick.
Oh, sure.
And so she has not touched morels since, but I was like, was it hollow? Because that was one of the things. And she said she thought it was, but she didn't know if it really was a morel or something else. Because morels won't make you sick, right?
It's like anybody can be sensitive to any food. Oh, so she like could just allergy. Have, yep. And I know of a lot of people that ate morels for many, many years. And then all of a sudden one time they ate them and they got sick. And they could never eat them again. Like, they would try because they, you know, of course, they're so good. You really want to be able to eat these mushrooms. And then every time that they try it, they get sick. So I don't understand how that works. But there are some people that have that. And certain mushrooms are more likely to have people have a sensitivity.
Sure.
So
when it's kind of like with anything, though, if you eat it, a lot of it, all the time. So I am a big protein shake connoisseur, and I was putting raspberries and almond milk in my shake for years. And I recently took a food sensitivity test, and because I've always been, you know, really particular about my nutrition and wanting to make sure I'm eating things that I'm not sensitive to. Mm-hmm. And two things that came up, which I never thought would, that came up really high in my food sensitivity list was raspberries and almonds, because I was consuming so much of it that I think your body starts to develop like antibodies and things like that. So it's always important to, of course, eat a variety of things, and that's mm-hmm. why, but I could see that happening, especially with a mushroom that probably has some molds on it or, you know, things like that, where your body could be sensitive to some of that if you're eating a lot.
Mm-hmm. And also, too, when you first try a mushroom, you know, we always recommend people just try a small amount rather than, as tempting as it is to gorge yourself on morels, if you've never had them before, try it. Just, you know, have a few bites or, you know, don't eat too many, but... Yeah, similar story with hen of the woods. My mom and brother both gorged themselves on hen of the woods one time. And it wasn't a mushroom I picked, so I'm just going to throw that out there. Somebody else had picked it. So it could have been a bad mushroom, like, you know, maybe too old or something. But they both got sick after eating that mushroom. And they, again, anytime they try it again, they'll get sick. So
isn't that interesting? Yeah, you just have to, that is smart to try a little bit at a time just to make sure that you don't have a food sensitivity. Is there a certain, like, do you have a favorite recipe that is like, oh my gosh, this is my go-to every time, you know, a favorite mushroom recipe that you like? Of course, everybody morel is like, all you do is put a little, dredge them in a little flour and cook them in some butter and that's all you do. But there's got to be a lot more recipes out there than that.
Well, one of the things that's great about working with Gentleman Forager is that we work with chefs all the time, like really, really great chefs. So I'm looking forward to learning that amazing, like, kind of go-to simple recipe. I don't get real creative yet with my mushrooms. I almost always recommend people just saute them in butter and, you know, add a little salt and just have it plain, like, the first time that you want to taste a mushroom. So you can really get the flavor and enjoy it rather than, you know, mixing it in with something, you know, you might just kind of lose the flavor. So definitely, you know, merels, of course, are just amazing anyway, but yeah, butter and salt, it sounds simple, you know, and then maybe adding, like Mike recommends, adding a little bit of thyme or something just to jazz it up a little bit, and some shallots. So like that's so good. Easy. Otherwise,
you know, I made my, when I got home from our foraging day, I did cook up some of the morels. My boyfriend Dan was in town, so he had not had a morel before. So I was like, you are in for a treat. And I didn't show him any of the worms that were on the before when I brought them home. I just cooked them. I soaked them, then cooked them. But I used one of my favorite, I'm a big fan of salts, like either smoked sea salt or and shiitake or umami sea salt. Is my favorite. So umami sea salt is basically a sea salt that has dried shiitake mushroom in it. And umami, they say it's like your sixth sense or something like that. It has to do with your taste, of your taste buds. You know, you have sweet, savory, something. And I'm not doing this justice. But umami sea salt is amazing on anything from steak, chicken, venison, you name it. And I use that in with a little bit of the butter, my morel mushrooms, and instead of using plain sea salt, they use the shiitake sea salt. It was so good. So good. And I did put a tiny dash of cream in there. But I just served it over, kind of make a little sauce. And then I just drizzled it over just a chicken breast, you know, something that I had in the fridge. And it was so delicious. So that's my tip. Not that I'm a mushroom chef by any means, but the umami sea salt. And you can't, they have one at Trader Joe's. Not that I don't like Trader Joe's. It's not the same there.
Okay.
I get mine from a place called Oaktown Spice Shop, and I'm sure there's some other spice shops locally that have them that make it from scratch. This one happens to be in California, and they do mail order, so I order it from there. But their umami sea salt, they make it small batch, and it is a game changer in my eyes. So that's my mushroom cooking tip for the day.
Thank you. I did bring you some more morels today.
You did?
Too. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Well,
so you can try some more recipes.
You are spoiling me. That is so sweet of you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
My goodness. I even shared with my dad because he is always so kind. You know, he shared some of his wild turkey with me. So when I had extra morels, I did bring those to him because he is a huge morel mushroom fan. So I appreciate you sharing. That's really sweet. So you guys, I want our listeners, if they want to learn more, or you have some really cool events coming up too. So I just want to share those with our listeners, because if you want to really deep dive for a fun weekend of mushroom foraging, because morel season's pretty much over, you're going to do all the other really cool species. Mm-hmm. It looks like you have two events coming up. You have Forager's Feast. Are you part of that one? Yes, you are. Mm-hmm. Your name's on here. What is that?
Oh my gosh. So Forager Feast, we have this new chef, Patrick Attenellian. He is going to be preparing, I think, a 5-course. I'm not sure how many courses we're going to have, but between 4 and 6 courses utilizing wild foods, of course, mushrooms and other wild plants and even edible flowers, that whatever is in season. So when is that scheduled? July 8th?
Friday, July 8th.
Yeah, we will be having a lot more of those in the future.
That is so cool. If, you know, we at Minnesota Bound have, we have our wild game dinners that we do in the winter time, and it's like a 5-course, you know, wild game, feast per se, but to attend these really unique, you know, easy foraging feast or whatever. It's such a unique experience, mm-hmm. and you'll be able to taste, you know, recipes and flavors that you would probably never be able to accomplish on your own, just because the amount of variety of mushrooms you'll be using. But when a professional chef gets their hands on either wild game or foraged food, it is a whole different level of cooking.
Exactly.
So if you're listening and your Friday, July 8th is open, I would highly recommend that, because that sounds really cool.
Yeah. And unfortunately, I don't know the menu yet, because we're going to wait and see what is actually in season and utilize whatever we can. So, you know.
That's awesome. TBD. Well, whatever it is going to be delicious. And then you also have Shroomapalooza. Is that, that may be sold out already, but that sounded really cool. That's happening in, is that Crosby, Minnesota? Is that where you're going? Aiken, Minnesota?
Yes. Crosby. Yeah, that's Crosby, I believe.
Something.
Cross,
it's no, around
Cross
that
Lake.
Area.
Cross Lake
is yeah. where you're going. Okay.
Yeah, that's a super fun weekend. We're not sold out yet. I went to this last year for my first time, and it was such a unique weekend. So we will be having live music every, you know, Friday and Saturday night. So there's a live band playing. We will have Chef Ashley Estrada from the Sample Room cooking up every single meal. She is amazing. And so
it's every single meal. Like,
not just hot dogs and hamburgers.
No, it's, we're talking about mushrooms
wild,
and
yes,
food.
Wild foods. And like you said, like, I didn't know food could taste like this.
I know, when, it's totally different.
Which is another great benefit of joining Gentleman Forager. Like, I didn't know food could taste like this. So yes, he's definitely spoiling me. So yes, breakfast, lunch, dinner. And then we go foraging on Saturday. So we'll go out as a group and just spend hours in the woods, just roaming around. We'll bring a bag lunch with us so we can spend more time out there. And last year we stopped at a lake on the way back. It was a really warm day. So we went swimming in the lake and, and yeah, just like meeting, of course, you know, like-minded people, obviously, like, people that are into mushroom hunting are pretty
unique,
pretty, yes, unique and like just good,
yeah,
good people. So it was so fun. I met so many people and yeah, all
Salt
you have to do
earth.
Is pack a cooler, a beer or whatever you like to drink. We, you know, so you can drink what you want, but other than that, you know, it's pretty much all taken care of. And you can do an RV or a tent. It's a big open field, so there's plenty of room to, or even a hammock. There's trees you can
sleep under the stars, yeah. People. Yeah, that's July, weekend of July 15th in Cross Lake. And that is definitely a hands-on in the woods experience. It looks like it'd be a really great time. Again, live music, culinary chef. When you say culinary chef and camping, that's when you're hooking people up because, you know, a lot of times, you know, when you're camping, you're just doing hot dogs over mm-hmm. a campfire, right? Because it's mm-hmm. just easy or, you know. So to have a chef there with you, that sounds pretty special.
Yeah, I don't think there's any other events out there that do
no,
something
Shroomapalooza,
like this.
So, I love yeah. the name too. Well, Jamie, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. Your story is a fascinating one, and I love your passion for foraging and that you're following it. And I know that you're going to be nothing but successful. So
thank you.
I appreciate you coming by today.
It was so fun.
And one last thank you to our sponsors, Kinetico, Minnesota Propane, Star Bank, Hewitt Docks, Oreo and Ritz, and Minnesota Historical Society. Last but not least, don't forget, introduce a kid to the great outdoors.